Thank you for inviting me to be here. Thank you for letting me sit with you and bow and chant with you. And I'm so glad to hear you're taking your practice into the world. And I'm also very glad to know that White Tara is there with you. I'm a Zen practitioner, but I love White Tara. So, and I figure we can use all the help we can get. So there you go. Wise. So I wanted to talk to you tonight about koans. In our Soto Zen tradition, koans are like family stories passed to us from the ancients, from the ancestors. And we have the koans of our lives. And I don't think it's a surprise to anyone if I say that we certainly are in the middle of one vast, big upside-down koan in these times. Is what is the bodhisattva path? How do we live and respond? What's appropriate response? What is our responsibility? So I've been having fun in the sangha that I lead. We've been looking at the ancient koans with these questions in mind, not as something stuck in the past that some strange old Zen masters did, but as relevant and alive and here. And I would recommend, I'll refer to it a little tonight. I don't know if you can see it in the room, but I think on screen you can. It's called Zen Echoes, Classic Koans with Verse Commentaries by Three Female Zen Masters, because most of the koans passed to us, most of them don't have women in them. So just a little introduction to these three amazing women, their voices. Mai Zhang from the 12th century. Famous for being one of the first officially recognized female Chan masters in Chinese history. I'm also aware through Doralee that you guys, just some of you just did a women's retreat, so this kind of fits right in. She wrote commentaries on a lot of verses, and they're included in this book. And then to me, most marvelous is that 500 years later in the 17th century, long after her death, two Dharma companions, and I apologize because I'm probably going to say their names wrong, but I'm sure they'll forgive me, and I hope you will too. Bauchi and Zuki were so inspired by her commentaries that they began to comment on her commentaries, and back and forth with each other, resounding across time and space. So they took the original koans, and then they took Mai Zhang's, and then it just has this feeling of, well, it's Zen echoes, singing, and to this moment. So I can't imagine they wouldn't be delighted that their words are echoing here. And I want to bring forward some of what I consider our Zen ancestors, in particular Zen ancestors, in our time. And to acknowledge each of you, because who's going to do it if we don't? So there you go. I wanted to read you the first sermon that Mai Zhang gave when she ascended the seat as the abbess. And it's recommended because it's so strong. She's so clear. And she's so grounded in her wisdom and her view. When it comes to the path of transcendence, sages do not transmit anything, and students do nothing but toil over forms, like monkeys grasping at their own reflections. What Shakyamuni Buddha transmitted at Vulture Peak came at an opportune time. He elaborated upon the three vehicles, each according to the faculties and capacities of his listeners, and beginning at the Deer Park with his teachings of the Four Noble Truths, he ferried hundreds of thousands of beings across the river of samsara in this world of suffering. Today, I, this is Meizhong speaking, the mountain monastic, together with this world and all other worlds, with the Buddhas and the patriarchs, with the mountains and rivers and great earth, the grasses and trees, woods and forests, appear before the fourfold assembly, each of us turning the great wheel of Dharma. Each of us turning the great wheel of Dharma. And then she says, everyone's radiances blend and crisscross like a jeweled silken net. It's the jewel net of Indra, everything resonating and touching everything across time and space, radiant to this very moment. If there is a single blade of grass, a single tree that does not turn the wheel of Dharma, then one cannot call my sermon today a true turning of the great wheel of Dharma. Everything, nothing left out, all inclusive. The whole world is Buddha's body. That is one of my favorite Dogen quotes to live by. What's the appropriate response when the whole world is Buddha's body? Nothing left out, everything included. Here's another quote from Dogen. Your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although not noticed by others or by yourself, it is so. What a joyful responsibility. Our practice, continuous practice, is touching and creating and co-creating everything. So, of course, we have hold of you. We're hardwired that there is this and that and you and me and right and wrong and good and bad. And how do we respond from a place of bodhisattva eyes, awareness, love, compassion, so that more and more that which is flaring on fire in this samsara world remembers itself, remembers peace and harmony, and that we aren't separate. How do we remember how to take care of each other? So here's the koan from this book. In Zen Echoes, it's listed as case number 8. And many of you, if not all of you, know it well. I'm going to read it to you. When Buddha was on Vulture Peak, he twirled a flower before the assembly, and everyone was silent. Only Maha Kashyapa smiled, and Buddha said, I have the eye treasury of the true teaching, the heart of Nirvana, the true form of non-form, and the ineffable gate of Dharma. It is a special transmission outside the teaching, and I now entrust it to Maha Kashyapa. Just this simple act of Buddha held up a flower, and Maha Kashyapa smiled. Nothing too fancy, nothing too Dharma, nothing too Zen, just this simple act of meeting, of presence. So let me just a little bit of, so we all arrive on the same page, is in early Buddhism, just to remind us, in the Pali, Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, was the Buddha. He was the guy. He was a person who vowed committed his whole life and heart to sitting down on the earth and discovering and overcoming the root of human suffering. And he did it with and for all beings. And then he set up a whole method. We know the Four Noble Truths. We know the Eightfold Path, the teachings, and set up a structure and the Sangha in which people practiced. The Lotus Sutra, Mahayana Sutra, turned that understanding. In fact, it turned it so much that 500 monks walked out. Like, but this isn't what you told us, because what the Buddha says in the Lotus Sutra is that his appearing as a singular person and as the Buddha was just skillful means, because we needed to see a human being do this to understand that we could do it and that it was possible. But that, in fact, it was just expedient means, skillful means, because there are Buddhas across time and space. And that each person is a Buddha waking up to be a Buddha. In fact, there is not, this is more the Avatamsaka Sutra, there is not a square inch on earth where there hasn't been a Buddha sitting and waking up, including the spot you're sitting in right now. Buddha's sitting and waking up. This isn't a soul lone act. This is something that we are all doing together. And that this waking up, awakening, that we thought just happened under the Bodhi tree with the Buddha, just involves the faith, the ongoing faith of continuous practice rooted in that the world as it is, seen with its true eyes, seen through the true eyes of Buddha, beyond our conceptual projections, is just things as it is. It's isness, it's suchness, it's love, it's interconnection, it's everything flowing in and out of everything else, and that the entire world is Buddha's body. One might, I suppose, even say that the true nature, the Buddha nature of everything, is a kind of basic goodness. And our job then is, through infinite skillful means, that there's no particular Buddhist or Zen way to do this, is what is the appropriate response? That everything is potentially a means of awakening. So how do we meet each other? How do we meet our thoughts? How do we meet those who we think are other? This is the koan. Buddha twirled a flower and Mahakashyapa smiled. What is it that will come through you in each moment? How will we embody and enact this? Because this is what bodhisattvas do and what bodhisattvas are. And it's all points of meeting, resounding across time and space. Gesundheit. And it all happens in relationship and interrelationship. And that being is by its nature sharing and loving, and compassion is our mutual shared awakening. I think this is wonderful. This makes me happy. This feels to me, in times when we have all and will probably all feel fear and despair and anger and the whole range of human feelings, is that this is the true ground of being. This is what we are when we sit in Zazen. This is what we affirm, Zazen body. We drop body and mind, and it is the whole world right here. And that when we can affirm that, it actually touches the past, it touches the present, and we, in ways we will never be able to imagine, help to create and co-create the world that we know is possible and that is already right here. So I thought, just to affirm this, here's some words from Ancestor Zenju Earthling Manuel in present moment. She says, the mind is inherently liberated, and liberation is always occurring. The ordinary mind continues to struggle and is held captive to this or that. It struggles to discard what is not wanted and to hold on to what is needed, favored, or wanted. But the true nature of mind is that there is no distinction or exclusion, no this or that. The mind is inherently liberated, even as one has thoughts about imposed distinction or exclusion, about injustices or the inherent tendency of humans to cause suffering to each other. Our natural state is already liberated and free. And we get to just remember and remind each other and affirm on a Monday evening. It's probably hot there. It's hot here. It's just, this is it. And then you're going to stand up and go walk. I'm actually sort of jealous that you guys are in Sacramento and that you're right there in the Capitol. I'm in Sebastopol and Santa Rosa, I mean, which is lovely, but I'm so with you in a heart right there. And then you'll do that. And then you'll remember when you're doing this or that, to feel your feet on the ground, to feel your breath, to come back to your heart, to the one heart of the world. And that if we're afraid Buddha, just be afraid Buddha. Just come to the center of it. If you're angry Buddha, just be angry Buddha. Just right in the center of it. It won't be the same as Chris being angry. It will move and open, and it will help everybody else around us. This is what bodhisattvas do. And then there's another Zen ancestor, Yunmen. When asked about the meaning of Buddhism, the whole body of the Buddhist teachings, he famously responded, an appropriate response. Not a reactive response, but an appropriate response arises from this Buddha body that is right here. This is how we change the world, moment after moment, choice after choice, together. Here's another ancestor, Joanna Macy. Given that we course together in radical interconnectedness, we belong to each other. We are all bodhisattvas. That is our true nature. What does all this mean for us in our own lives? What are the ways we can live in the world as a bodhisattva, entering freely and fully into the heart of things? The gifts of the bodhisattva are many, and a crucial one is simply sharing presence. A crucial one is simply sharing presence, as simple as the Buddha twirling a flower and Mahakashyapa smiled. They smiled together and the whole world cracked open. It is the gift of being fully here with eyes and ears open, not wishing you were somewhere else or comparing it to a place you prefer to be. It is being in the world as it is. Just presence, just breath, just body, feeling, sensations, formations, impulses, consciousness, just this. Complete human beings that are Buddhas waking up to be Buddha. It is an act of courage and freedom, Joanna Macy says, to be present unconditionally without referring to whether you like it or not. That unconditional presence is the first and essential act we must make. Simply to be here with open eyes, open ears, open heart, and all else flows from that. It always feels to me like Avalokiteshvara and her thousand hands and eyes, completely open and responsive. Opening to our mutual belonging, we feel the suffering, we don't shut it out. We need compassion because that openness to the pain of the world provides the fuel to move us out to where we need to be and to do what we need to do. And we need this wisdom of emptiness, suchness, isness, that knows how interwoven we are in the web of life, inseparable from each other. It teaches wisdom and compassion, the dual wings of wisdom and compassion, that we are so interconnected and interexisting that even the smallest act with clear intention has repercussions throughout the web of life. Like Mahjong and Bauchi and Tsuki resonating across time and space. We are so interconnected and interexisting that even the smallest act with clear intention has repercussions throughout the web of life. We are not powerless. And when you think you are, just take a breath and come back. Maybe come into the Zazen on a Monday evening. Feel the person next to you. Feel your own heart and deep intention. Remember that just the simple act of holding up a flower and one smile ripples across time and space to us right here and in this moment. And as Mahjong said, everyone's radiances blends and crisscrosses like a jeweled silken net. This is continuous practice. This is just the deepest truth of what is. So Bhikkhu Bodhi, another current era bodhisattva, says that what arises from this, he calls it conscientious compassion. Conscientious compassion. And that the core value of conscientious compassion is solidarity, the ability to identify with others. One might say to see each person as Buddha. It's a practice, ongoing and continuous. Solidarity gives rise to love and compassion. He reminds us that it's love as an active concern, not passive, not as an idea, but an active concern to promote the well-being of others. And compassion as the aspiration to liberate people and all sentient beings from suffering. It's the Bodhisattva vow. And he rightly goes on to remind us that for conscientious compassion to succeed, to be embodied, to be alive, we need courage. The readiness to respond, to listen deeply, to act, to be curious about skillful means on the behalf of all beings. I remember when I was ordained, Norman Fisher was my ordination teacher. And he said, I'll confess, I never really wanted to be ordained. I thought it looked a little too special to me. But I was convinced when he said there were three things. And I thought, well, that's my life anyway. I might as well just publicly say yes. First one was humility. Is once you know that you are a part of an interwoven, interconnected isness. And the more you study the self, you get very humble about your own hindrances, about how quickly reactiveness arises. And the humility that this is a path that goes on and on without end. And that somehow we found it and it found us. God, I'm in forever. Second one was being of service. Because once you know all this, or you taste it, because you taste it and then you forget it, but then you, it's just, how can I be of service? Again, that's the Bodhisattva vow. Skillful means, solidarity, conscientious compassion. It's a natural outflow from this place. And acts big or small, because everybody's going to do it completely differently. Some people went out and marched probably on Saturday. I think it was Saturday. And will again. And some people found another way to express their caring. Anything that's done with clear intention, with love and an understanding of caring for one thing is caring for everything, is the path. And the third one was seeing each person as Buddha. Everyone is a Buddha waking up to be a Buddha. We are already, in ways we can't even imagine across time and space, already Buddhas, and showing up here as Bodhisattvas. I always think Bodhisattvas, I mean, my understanding of a Bodhisattva is that if there's some place to get out of here too, is they get out of here and then they turn around and they say, well, I want to go back and I want to help there. Because you just know. It's like, what else are you going to do but try to figure out how to be of help in this life? And it's an ongoing act of practice when you're looking at somebody or something over there to remind ourselves, see each person as Buddha. In the world just as it is, each person just as they are in this moment, waking up to all of us, to what we don't yet know. How to embody and be. Dogen said, when you open your hand, it is just right. When you open your hand, it is just right. When your body is activated, it immediately appears. Truly, after Mahakashapa broke into a smile at Vulture Peak, the 28 Indian ancestors could not add even a slightest thread. Truly, after Mahakashapa broke into a smile at Vulture Peak, each of us will try to add something on top of it. That's what we do. But it's already right here. Just open your hand. It's just right. And when your body is activated, I call it Zazen body. We know this. We know the taste of it. We know how to come home. The Buddhas and ancestors are here. They're us. Giving and receiving, and no giver, no receiver, no gift. Not something outside of our lives. It is life, and we awaken to this. and we can't do it alone. We need Sangha. We need places to practice. I'm just constantly amazed how lucky I am that I fell into practice and practice fell into me. We remind and help each other. And I'm also more and more enjoying also getting involved in interfaith work. And I've always enjoyed just being involved with other human beings, all of us suffering and trying to wake up and care for ourselves and each other. Everything is in relationship with everything else, turning and being turned, awakening each other and the whole world. It's all meeting. It's all inclusive, specific in time and space, and in a genuine, authentic meeting, the whole world, everything cracks open. Sometimes it says Buddha twirled a flower and Maha Kashyapa's cracked a smile or his face cracked open. I think that's beautiful. So really, there's nothing else to do, and there's everything to do. And I, for one, am so grateful for the koans. It's really fun to look at these ancient teachings and to say, what does this have to do with this life and this moment? Because there's always been suffering, and there's always been, probably, let's hope not always, hardship and suffering. So one might say, from a bodhisattva's point of view, it's like, okay, here we are. We got born in this time, and how are we going to help each other and the world remember who we are and what the true nature of everything is? So that's my little pep talk. I give these pep talks to myself. It's nice to give them to other people, to share it. When I went on Saturday, when I enter that world that the world is asking some of us to enter, I wear my rakasu. I actually wear my robes too, because it helps me remember what's true and how I want to be. And maybe if I remember, it will help somebody else. Someone's afraid, or things get triggered or reactive. So that's just my way, but let's help each other remember being true human beings. That's all I got. What do you got? Anybody want to say anything? Share your experiences, questions, encouragements?
Hi, Chris. My name is Oscar.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you very much for this very boundless, inclusive vision and expression, which I totally believe and also often forget, particularly when this very moment is, I have this dream, it's not to my liking, and sometimes people are not to my liking. Sometimes I can recover from that pretty quickly. Lots of times I can't. It takes a while. What are your thoughts about what magic thought can I have at such times to help me maintain my balance?
Yeah, good question for all of us. I think each person has to find, maybe there's a phrase, maybe there's a word, maybe there's a putting your hand on your heart. And I thought, because everything you said, me too. I mean, I think if we're honest, we're human beings. Is that underlying and woven through all of this is just grief. It's just tenderness and poignancy and sadness and grief. So somehow that helps me. It helps me come back into my body and back into my heart, because everything else feels I at a certain point I love the verse of repentance or confession in our bodhisattva vows, which to me I for a while I would say them every morning and every night, and now it feels like to me it's like confessing that I'm a human being, and I'm finally landing in being a human being instead of being ashamed or othering it or trying to change it. Is like once I land there and can feel the grief and the sadness and the love, something else happens. I'll just say the all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. That's not unlike the service you just did. I just think greed, yep. Hate, yep. Delusion, confusion, yep. Okay, there's more space in here than there used to be, but it's not the problem. It's just remembering, that's all. So we're all in it together. That help at all?
Thank you very much, Chris. I think it did. I'll try it out, but I think it did. I'm especially drawn to your words about remembering that it's all sadness and grief and fear, and we're all in that pot together.
Yep. And I don't know about you, but my experience on Saturday was there's an enormous amount of joy. It's like,
yeah,
we can do it all.
It's ready to bust out.
Yeah. Love. Yeah.
I'll just take a seat right here so I'm not all the way off to the side. Well, to start, my name's Nicholas. I never got to actually formally just talk with anyone upon entering because I unfortunately arrived a little late and entered during the meditation, so there wasn't any chance to talk to or get to meet anybody. But well, this is my first time here, and you know, I automatically upon entering, I was greeted by Jody, who gave me a very warming welcome and you know, loving greeting. So I'm from a little bit about me. I'm from a Catholic background. I was never formally baptized or anything. My parents didn't baptize me for, I'm not really sure to be honest. I was brought up not religious per se, but I was brought up believing that, oh, there's a God. And, you know, we had prayers like at nighttime and stuff like that. And then I say when I became a teenager, then it kind of, there wasn't like any really religion in the house. And then ever since then, I've always been trying to discover like what's the purpose of life and what's like, what am I doing here on earth? And so I wanted to ask you specifically, Chris, what's your opinions on practicing Buddhism alongside other religions such as Catholicism or say Islam? What do you think of that?
Go for it. Why limit yourself? I've been told, and it's also my experiences, that at a certain point, it's kind of like taking one tradition and following it all the way through. But I know in my experience, because I was raised Christian and never penetrated. But Buddhism has, not because it's better, it's such a mystery what door we all walk in. And the more that happened, the more it opened the Christian tradition. And I just think every tradition's pointing at the same thing. It just different forms, different language, different entry gates. So good for you that you're here and you're asking the question. And you were raised in a household that gave you a good ground. Now you get to find out for yourself how to express that.
I agree, and that was one thing my parents had actually told me. They said, well, I mean, they tell me they wish they would have baptized me, but they said, but think of it this way, it allows you the opportunity to discover what works for you, you know, not what we chose for you at an infant. Because in, you know, my family's tradition, they, you know, traditional Catholics where they always baptize at infant age.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of it, and then you kind of just, you know, practice it secularly or just, oh, I'm Catholic and that's it kind of. You know, there's not really in-depth study on, like, the individual to educate themselves more on exactly what they were chosen to be, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you one more little story. I lived at Green Gulch for 10 years, San Francisco Zen Center, and met my husband there, and my son was born there. And Bruce, my husband, his mother, we're more and more aware, she was an Italian immigrant. She came here when she was 13, but that's not the point of the story. The point is that she was a devout Catholic. And she was really, it was very disturbing to her, the thought that her grandson, when he was born, was not going to be baptized. And maybe some of you know Brother David. This is a story about cross interfaith traditions. Brother David was there at that time practicing. A lot of Catholics at that time were coming because it seemed like the contemplative part of their tradition had been forgotten, and now it's, I think, much more enlivened. Anyway, he when he saw that, he said, well, then we have to do a Buddhist Christian baptism. And he couldn't do it because he was a Christian brother, but he found a Catholic priest who was willing to do this thing. And Richard Baker, who was the abbot at the time, and in the Green Gulch Zendo, we did a baptism for my little son that was a Buddhist Christian baptism. And I could just tell Brother David was as happy as he could possibly be, because it's like, why can't we make this as rich and deep and broad as the causes and conditions of our lives bring to us? So there you go. Who knows anything?
Well, that's very reassuring. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Hi, Chris. This is Jody. Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear.
Okay, so this is Jody, and I was really taken by the whole interconnectedness part of your talk, because I've been working on something, and today I just kept thinking about how every time any of us breathes, we're breathing in and breathing out, and billions of people all over the world are doing this every second of every day, and we're all connected just by the very air that we breathe, because what I breathe out, somebody else is breathing in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I've just kind of been floating in that, I guess, you know, which is really great, and it does not stop the tremendous rage that I feel about, you know, what's going on in the world and the kinds of despicable actions that are being taken. Um, So it's kind of this very strange place to be with just all this stuff rumbling around all at the same time.
Yep, that's the koan of it. That's the particular and the absolute, but those aren't even big enough words. It's just that's here we are on this planet, and I feel rage too. I mean, not all the time, but I can't believe what's happening. And I also know we're breathing each other in and out. It's palpable. I can feel it. And that feels like the bigger truth that can breathe with the rage so it doesn't get stuck someplace. It's just, it's painful. So yes, I think people say it in the San Francisco Zen Center in the dining room, there's a stained glass of Suzuki Roshi's hands. And the description is that one hand is the relative or the particular, or you could say the rage, and the other hand is the absolute, the universal, the suchness, the isness, that we are breathing each other in and out. And then you just bow moment after moment. You just bow because it's inexplicable. So yes, I bow to you.
For anyone on Zoom, I'm just checking, would like to express themselves. I don't think I see everybody, Anthony, so maybe you know. I don't know. Okay. Well, I did want to share something in relation to your talking about, you know, every little thing we do makes a big difference. And this weekend, some of us were at Green Gulch Farm for a women's retreat, and some of us decided that we were going to walk down to the Mirror Beach, where there was a kind of a gathering of people in the neighborhood for a rally for peace and democracy and, you know, humanity. And so we all walked down, and we carried Zenju Earthlin Manuel's chant for all beings on a piece of paper. And so we got there, and you know, everybody was like dancing to music and carrying their signs, and they were very welcoming. But there was kind of a us them in a way. We were like, you know, the 10 people from Green Gulch Farm, and then everybody else. And so anyway, at some point we decided we were going to chant this chant. And so some of us turned to some of the other people that were there and invited them to chant with us. And I'll just never forget, there was a man I was standing next to, and, you know, this dog, and, you know, he had, like, I don't know, like, his hands looked like they were really suffering, and we didn't really talk very much, but he said, yes, I'll chant. And we chanted together. And it was like this amazing thing that we had this incredible connection. I can see him so vividly in my mind, and it all changed how I felt being there. And I think it changed for him too. And some of the other people also joined in. So somehow we were all chanting together, and that was a little thing, but a big thing.
It feels like Buddha twirling a flower and Mahakashyapa smiled. I mean, it's just that. It's just a meeting in time and space.
Exactly.
Beyond time and space.
Yeah. Right, beyond time and space. Yeah, and it's a sense of being connected that was so deep and so real. And yet, on the surface, we knew nothing about each other. Yeah. Thank you.
I think that's the mystery.
Hey, and
we do know it. Yeah, go ahead, Susan.
I think Dora Lee just gave an example of what I'm going to ask about. You had the three things. There was humility, service, and then the one that's really hard is seeing everybody as a Buddha. And so I was going to ask you that, like, how do you do that? I mean, right? But I think Doralee just gave us an example of it, huh?
Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Doralee.
I was thinking also, I mean, part of that is, I think it's easy to say seeing each person as Buddha, like I'm going to see each one of you as Buddha, but to see ourselves as Buddha, which that, I mean, that's completely inexplicable and sounds like something extra, but just there was something in that story of just trust. It's trust of just trusting. Oh, let's just chant. And that's what comes, and somehow 10 people trusted that and somehow entrusted themselves to the gathering, and the gathering opened. So there is some kind of trust in this, the trusting our own deepest nature, and Suzuki Roshi called it intuition. There is a deeper intuitive body about appropriate response.
Well, this is, thank you so much. And I think you opened many doors for all of us. And I'm just smiling. I don't know if you see me, but I'm just smiling.
Well, thank you for opening the door for me. So we'll just all keep encouraging each other in ways big and small, and knowing that each one of us is going to do it. It's not going to look the same. Just really trust your own heart, body, and practice.